If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's interviews with authors Salman Rushdie and Celeste Ng, both of whom take a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
Every week, it seems like we've seen Donald Trump at his worst, and every week, he finds a way to sink lower. And now, with his response to the crisis in Puerto Rico, we are witnessing once again the very real consequences of electing a lazy, ignorant racist as president. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. The scale of the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico cannot be overstated. Over 3 million U.S. citizens living there have been without power. More than half the population doesn't have access to clean drinking water. Food is scarce, roads are damaged, and gas has been in short supply. And yet our president seems to know only one thing about the situation, that Puerto Rico is an island.
It's on an island in the middle of the ocean. It's out in the ocean.
This is an island sitting in the middle of an ocean, and it's a big ocean. It's a very big ocean.
This is an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water.
Water. The whole thing's like getting a situation report from a cartoon caveman. But it's not fair to keep harping on the fact that Trump is dumb. Let's not forget, he's also lazy. The day after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, Trump jetted to New Jersey to spend a long weekend at his private golf club. The sense of urgency didn't begin to penetrate the White House until Monday, when images of the utter destruction and desperation and criticism of the administration's response began to appear on television. So Trump literally needed the TV to tell him to help Puerto Rico. Trump watches so much TV, at this point, even golf announcers will start dropping hints for him about how to do his job.
And a short putt here for McIlroy, but he looks distracted.
He's probably focused on President Trump's tweets about North Korea this morning.
That's gotta be on his mind.
He's looking at the hole and thinking, please, Mr. President, stop calling him Little Rocket Man.
And when you think about it, if there's a nuclear war, then there would be no more golf.
Good point.
And here's the putt for par. And he missed it.
That's what happens when the president tweets crazy.
And on top of that is what happened. And on top of that, Trump's acting Homeland Security director made things worse when she called the recovery effort a good news story. And when she heard that comment, the mayor of San Juan was understandably frustrated, pleading in interviews and press conferences for more help and a greater sense of urgency for the people of Puerto Rico. And in return, Donald Trump did what any leader would do. He berated the people begging him for help.
President Trump is attacking the mayor of San Juan in a barrage of early morning tweets.
The mayor of San Juan, who was very complimentary only a few days ago, has now been told by the Democrats that you must be nasty to Trump. Such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico, it's another tweet, who are not able to get their workers to help. They want everything to be done for them when it should be a community effort.
Everything? They want electricity and drinking water, not Rihanna tickets and a new Tesla. Now, obviously, many Americans are angry about the president's choice to lash out at the mayor of San Juan instead of focusing on hurricane relief. But no one is madder than Puerto Ricans themselves. One of our writers, Jenny Hagel, is Puerto Rican, and she's here to comment right now. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you, Seth. First of all, can we see a clip of Mayor Cruz being nasty, please?
When you're drinking from a creek, it's not a good news story. When you don't have food for a baby, it's not a good news story. Damn it, this is not a good news story. This is a people are dying story. This is a life or death story.
If you think that's nasty, you've never seen a Puerto Rican woman get mad. She didn't even throw her shoe. You don't believe me? One time during a parent-teacher conference, my mom told my teacher to go to hell. And my teacher was a priest. Also, here's how I know that's not nasty. She didn't even switch over to Spanish. Because that's when you know you're in trouble with a Puerto Rican woman. If Mayor Cruz ever goes full Puerto Rican on you, tú vas a pedir a Dios que Kim Jong-un te mande la bomba. Sinvergüenza. You might be thinking, well, if she didn't get that mad, maybe she's not Puerto Rican. But you know how I know she is? Because she's in the middle of a storm and she still looks good. Look at those glasses. Meanwhile, you look like a hurricane hit you on a normal day. Mira, quit calling Mayor Cruz nasty. That's not the word you mean. You mean non-compliant. You're mad because you were challenged by a woman of color. You're mad that a woman of color is more compassionate and better at her job than you because you don't like us. And I know why. It's because we have the thick, wavy hair you so desperately crave. I lose more hair in the shower in the morning than you have on your whole head. You zanahoria arrugada. So remember, if you know what's good for you, don't step to a Puerto Rican woman. You can't handle it. Gusano parlante con cara de dragón y manos como una muñeca fea. Back to you, Seth.
Jenny Hagel, everybody.
Well, you know,
it's not fair of us to keep harping on the fact that Trump is dumb and lazy. Let's not forget he's also a liar. And any Trump crisis would not be complete without a bizarre and unnecessary lie fabricated out of whole cloth. Like this tweet when Trump tried to brag about his response to the hurricane. People are now starting to recognize the amazing work that has been done by FEMA and our great military. All buildings now inspected for safety. Sounds reassuring, except for the fact that Puerto Rican officials literally had no idea what Trump was talking about. Asked about Trump's tweet, the governor of Puerto Rico said, "All buildings, I'm not aware of such inspection." Perhaps he was referring to a particular set of buildings. I'm not sure. Just imagine how scary his lie about building safety would be if his previous job was buildings. Oh, someone better check those inspection papers. Seriously. And you better pray they don't look like this. With his insults this weekend, Trump proved once again how petty and cruel he can be. And look, I know he won't listen to me, or the media, or the mayor of San Juan, but he does usually listen to the military. So I'll let retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, who was in Puerto Rico while Trump was at his golf course, sum this whole thing up.
What is your reaction to the president's tweets this morning?
I have no reaction. The mayor's living on a cot, and I hope the president have a good day at golf.
Damn. Were you in the Army or SEAL Team SAS? This is the cruel racism of Donald Trump at work. When the victims of hurricanes in Florida and Texas needed help, he didn't hesitate. But when the victims are people of color and when the critics challenging him are women of color, his reaction is to insult them, drag his feet on sending help, and bring up financial issues. For example, no one ever asked how Texas and Florida would pay for their recoveries, but Trump has repeatedly raised the issue with Puerto Rico, tweeting about its massive debt and the billions of dollars owed to Wall Street and the banks, which sadly must be dealt with. And yet at the same time, his own administration is pushing forward on a plan that will help the rich, a giant tax cut.
President Trump and Republican lawmakers making the case for their newly unveiled tax plan.
An independent nonpartisan group has come out and said that 80% of the benefits by 2027 will accrue to the top 1%. If that means if you're a family making over $900,000, under the plan details that we know so far, you're going to get a $200,000 tax cut.
The Tax Policy Center also estimates the plan would add $2.4 trillion to the deficit over 10 years.
So while he chides Puerto Rico for not paying its debts, Trump is willing to spend trillions on a plan that would cut his own taxes. That is, if he even keeps his money here in the U.S. I have a feeling he's got his money stashed away on
an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water.
Water. Water. So, in the middle of a disaster, Trump is worried about finding the money to save lives in Puerto Rico, but isn't as concerned about spending $2 trillion on tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy. And not only that, Trump's cabinet of millionaires and billionaires is so out of touch, they can't even lie about their tax plan effectively. Last week, Trump economic advisor Gary Cohn, a multimillionaire former Goldman Sachs executive, tried to claim middle-class taxpayers would get a tax cut of about $1,000 a year. But when he offered examples of ways families could spend that money, he didn't seem to know how much everyday items cost.
If we allow a family to keep another $1,000 of their income, what does that mean? They can renovate their kitchen. They can buy a new. They can buy a new car.
Huh? You think it costs $1,000 to buy a new car? The best you could do with $1,000 is take Uber everywhere for a week. Also, I love that he thinks the first thing a middle-class family would do with $1,000 is renovate their kitchen. Okay, honey, we could pay off our student loans or these medical bills, or we could get that hot property brother to add subway tile to the breakfast nook. Oh, hey, I just found a $5 bill in my jeans. Why don't I take us all to the movies? Popcorn? Of course, it's a five. So Trump doesn't have the basic human decency to show compassion and grace towards victims of a natural disaster, and his party is more concerned with cutting taxes for the rich. But if there's one thing we can all agree on, surely it's that children deserve health care. Republicans have always proclaimed themselves the party of family values, so I'm sure they would never let a government program that provides health care to millions of children expire without doing anything about it. And there's no way this next clip will prove me wrong.
Funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP, expired today after Congress failed to come up with the necessary $15 billion. Created 20 years ago with bipartisan support, CHIP provides insurance for 9 million kids whose families make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but too little to buy their own insurance.
Man, how soulless do you have to be to let children's health insurance expire? I'd say Paul Ryan would have trouble looking at himself in the mirror if he had a reflection. This week has once again given us very clear proof of who Donald Trump really is and who he and the GOP really serve. Suffering U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico are desperate for help, and millions of children need health care. But Trump and the GOP have no problem spending $2 trillion on tax cuts for the rich. We'd all be a lot better off if Trump would just stop being president. He could go anywhere. You know, even
an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water.
Water. This has been a closer look. Our guest is a best-selling, world-renowned author. His 13th novel, The Golden House, is available now. Please welcome to the show, Salman Rushdie, everybody. How are you?
I'm really very well, thank you.
Congratulations on finishing the book, having it out. It must feel very nice to be done with it.
Yes, it feels like you have your brain removed. Really. Yeah. That's what it feels like, because there's nothing left in here.
And then how long does it take for your brain to regenerate? You don't know?
I have no idea.
That's nice.
My brain can't think about it.
That's right, of course. You're in a place of ultimate peace. So this book is about an Indian billionaire who moves to New York, his son's sort of suspicious circumstances and background, and it's narrated by their neighbor, who's a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Was that something you had to come up with in the very beginning, that, oh, I'm going to have the narrator have this film director's eye?
You know, I didn't, because I knew I wanted him to be a young guy and to be a born and raised New Yorker, but I had this really awful idea that he should be a writer. And I started writing it like that, and then I literally woke up in the middle of the night and sat up in bed and thought, this sucks. This is, you know, he should be, anything would be better. He could be a dentist.
Yeah.
He could be a hairdresser. He could be a tax accountant. All of those would be better. So then I went to sleep and woke up and I thought, well, okay, so he's not a writer, so who is he? And then I knew a bunch of young filmmakers in the village, you know, and I thought, well, maybe he's one of them. And the moment I thought that he was a filmmaker, the whole book opened out.
That must be an incredible moment to see it open out in front of you like that.
Yeah, because I mean, I've been kind of a film nerd all my life, and I finally had a character that I could give him all my film nerdery.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and so he could be the film nerd.
The political backdrop of our last election is happening during this book. There, you mentioned Bernie by name, you mentioned Hillary by name. You do not mention Trump by name. In fact, you go a very different direction, which is there's a candidate who has green hair who is called the Joker.
Yeah.
Completely
different.
Completely different. Exactly. And no one will ever connect the two. Have an eye for these things, so exactly. I figured it out, but... Yeah. Obviously, you made a choice not to mention Trump by name. Yeah. What led you to that decision?
Well, first of all, it was too boring.
Yeah.
You know, and secondly, it was too boring. And then I thought, if you look at a deck of cards, in a deck of cards, the two cards that don't behave like the other cards are the Trump and the Joker.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't want the Trump, so I'll have the Joker.
Yeah, that works out very well. You know, you wrote this book. You started writing this book
way before
2008. Is that about right?
Yeah.
And it's inspired by Indian billionaires you know about, you've read about. And yet now people are reviewing the book and saying, "Oh, this is very this clear."
It's really strange because, unfortunately, I have to admit that Nero Golden, who is the main character, is in the real estate business.
Right.
And he has a very beautiful, much younger gold digger, Eastern European trophy wife.
So
I'm sorry, but this was all made up before we knew anything about anyone else, any other real estate developer.
That is, you know, with that said, it feels like not just this book, but all art now is being seen through the prism of Trump, whether everything, or not it was inspired by
everything
or not.
Leads to Trump.
Yeah.
Whatever, you could be talking about New York Fashion Week and you'll be talking about Trump. You know, whatever you're doing, you could be talking about tennis, you'll be talking about Trump. It's really, that's one of the reasons I didn't want that word in my book.
You have a problem, which is Trump likes you.
Allegedly.
Yeah. But you mentioned tennis. Is it true that he tried to get you to watch some tennis with him?
Well, I met him somewhere and at some event, and he asked, it was around the time of the US Open, and he asked me if I liked to go, and I said I did. And he said very sweetly that I could borrow his box whenever I wanted, but... Because he's Mr. Trump, he also said that it was the best box.
Oh, wow, and yeah.
And that, you know, you really should see my box because it's a really great box. And I, even then, this was long before he had any political aspirations, even then I thought this would be a career-ending move.
Yeah, absolutely, just to be seen in his box,
to be seen in his
enjoying
box.
It.
So I didn't do it, but it was nice of him to offer.
That's very good, that's very good. I was, I feel as though you see the name Salman Rushdie. Maybe you're watching Charlie Rose. Maybe you're watching something on PBS, a show that reviews books. You came up on the season premiere of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, I heard that.
That is not where I would expect to hear your name, but it seems like the thrust of this season is that Larry David has written a play called Fatwa about you and the fact that the Ayatollah put a fatwa on you. Was it nice to see or hear that they were using this moment, this very charged moment of your personal life in comedy ways?
No, they did run it by me.
Oh, that's very nice. They did. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they would have not done it if I'd said no.
Right. I think that's very safe, yeah.
I think
will you give us our permission? No? Then I have some bad news.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It was actually nice because this is obviously a moment that's passed, particularly with your book, Satanic Verses. I've heard you say that it's nice now that people can actually read that book removed of the fact that it was so controversial that a fatwa was issued against it.
And when people read it, they notice that it's funny.
Right.
And it was one of the weird things that happened to me is that because the attack was not funny, it was assumed that the book couldn't be funny. And because the attack was kind of weird and incomprehensible and foreign and theological, it was assumed that the book would be weird and incomprehensible and theological and incomprehensible. You know, and somehow I acquired the characteristics of the attack against me. And I've had to sort of get out from under that cloud. And so I think in a funny way, Curb Your Enthusiasm making jokes about it is kind of cool because it defuses it.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, and it must be, it must have been so strange. I mean, for many reasons, obviously, a death threat against your life was probably the top of the worst parts about it.
Yes.
But your book got hijacked.
Yes, the book got hijacked. It is nice to see it being read like a book.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so some people like it, some people hate it. That's okay.
That's
the normal life of a book, which it didn't have. Now it does.
Not normal is a fatwa. That's very rare.
No, I would avoid if possible.
Okay, gotcha. That's good to know. Well, you came out of it looking great, and thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Salman Rushdie, everybody. The Golden House available now.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Salman Rushdie. So you and Seth were just talking about your book, and I wanted to ask you about the style of the book, because a lot of your work has been described as magical realism. This book has fewer maybe magical elements than your previous work. Was that a stylistic choice you made from the beginning, or did the story you wanted to tell bring you to that?
Well, it began as a result of the story, because, you know, the previous novel that I wrote, 2 Years, 8 Months, 28 Nights, it's also a New York novel, but it's kind of a fairy tale of New York. It has flying carpets and genies in it. And almost immediately that I finished it, I thought about this book as a kind of opposite kind of novel. It's a kind of social panorama of what's been going on in New York and America in the last decade. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, there's no room in this for flying carpets. This needs to be minus the fantasy, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was dictated by that. But then also what happened as I was writing it and as events developed in America in the run-up to the election, I actually thought there's so much make-believe being launched on the public at the moment. There's so much untruth and fiction and fakery that maybe it's a good thing to just avoid that a little bit in the novels. You know, because one of the things that the novel as a form has always been very good at is establishing between the writer and the reader an agreement about the nature of the truth. You know, the reader reads the book, and if he likes it, he thinks, yeah, this is how it is. You know,
and
it may be that we need that right now. We need to reestablish people's idea of the truth.
Right. Yeah. We were talking about everything kind of relating back to Trump, but it seems like literature, and especially novels, have this kind of increased power right now in terms of reality. That's really
interesting. I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I hope so. You know, you don't want to overclaim. You know,
sure.
Because not that many books really have a big political effect, you know. I mean,
right.
One or two. I mean, Uncle Tom's Cabin, maybe, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm. Your writing process is that you kind of get up every morning, sit down at the computer, and the first thing you do is write.
Yeah.
Why is it important for you to kind of do that first thing in the morning?
Well, I just have this theory, which works for me, I guess, is that you wake up every day with a little bundle of creative energy for that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can use it or you can waste it. And if you start off by making phone calls and answering emails and sending text messages, then it's gone.
Sure.
You know? So what I do is literally, even before I have a shower, I just, you know, in my pajamas, I'll just go to the desk and start. And then when I kind of have a bit of a sense of what I have to do today, then I can go and get dressed and have a cup of coffee and et cetera. But I need to get into it right away.
Do you enjoy it, or is it just part of your morning routine?
No, I mean, you enjoy it some days.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some days where you sit there and have nothing.
I get very dictatorial with myself on those days, you know, because I think it's so easy to allow yourself to succumb to the fact that it's a bad day and not do any work.
Right.
And then you don't finish a novel. A novel is a really long piece of work. You know,
of course.
The only way you finish it is to chip away at it. It's like being a marathon runner.
Right.
And so I don't allow myself those days. Mm-hmm. I set myself a number of words that I have to do a day, and I just write them.
Mm-hmm. And you you don't like sharing work before it's done.
No, I'm scared.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've written so many books. You've been critically acclaimed.
Yeah, you know, first of all, it doesn't get easier.
I can imagine.
And secondly, you don't get that any more confident because each book is completely unlike the one before, and you know, and you're only as good as your last book. You know, and I find that books in progress, work in progress, is so fragile. And the author is so emotionally fragile about it.
Yeah,
that it's. It's dangerous. I mean, like, if I'm working on something and I show it to you and I know that it's not finished, and you say, yeah, it's interesting, but it's not finished, then I get depressed.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it makes me lose my confidence sometimes. So I don't do that.
Interesting.
I get it to a point where I think I can't make it any better.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm really interested in what other people have to say.
It makes sense, yeah. What advice do you give to young writers?
Just get to the end. You know, I mean, it's one of the strange things. Somebody, might have been Philip Roth, can't remember, said writers are people who finish books. and I think, but there's another thing, which is, in my experience, every time I've actually got to the end, I can see the book in a way that I can't see it when I'm in the middle of it. And I can immediately see what it needs. You know, I can see that this bit needs improving, that bit needs cutting, this bit needs expanding. It becomes clear when you've got something there. Right. And after that, you know, revision is easier than something out of nothing.
Of course.
Something out of nothing is what's hard. So the moment you've got something on the page that you can work with, it's easier to fix it than to make it up in the first place.
Right. I had a teacher once say the best thing that can happen to a young writer is to lose your first draft completely. Because if you lose your first draft, you'll only remember the good parts.
That's a good idea, actually.
And
I'd never tried that.
It's the worst feeling in the world. I'm sure you've lost manuscripts and you've lost...
I've lost stuff. You know, I mean, I have, in the early days of computers, I did have a computer crash, you know, and lost a number of pages.
Right.
And I just decided not to panic and just sat there and did it again, like at once.
Right.
And the revised version came out shorter.
Yeah, of course, always. I mean, and probably better.
And maybe better.
Sure. It's funny, we were talking about how everything in this world, even literature, relates back to Trump. But I do want to ask you another Trump question. You and Seth were talking about, you were telling him the story of the U.S. Open. You've met him two other times.
I have. Well, the first time I met him, the U.S. Open was the third and last time I met him.
Okay.
First time I met him was a long time ago. It was maybe 2000, 2001. I met him at a Crosby, Stills, and Nash concert.
I think I said to you earlier, it sounds like the setup to a joke. Salman Rushdie and Donald Trump walked
to a Crosby, Stills, and Nash concert. It was at the Garden. He was there with his two, with his children, you know, with the two horrible sons and the much younger Ivanka, and obviously no Tiffany, poor girl. And I just accidentally had seats near his seats, and I was surprised by the fact that he seemed to know the words to the songs, that he was like on his feet singing along to Woodstock.
Fantastic.
And I thought, that doesn't sound plausible,
no.
but it's true. So that was the first time. And then some years later, I met him by chance again at the opera. I met him at the Met when we were just passing each other in the corridor. And as he went past me, he extended his very long and shapely index fingers.
Yeah, of course.
And said, "You're the man. You're the man." And I thought, I was so surprised that I looked behind me in case the man was behind me, you know, but apparently I was the man. And I have no idea why, but I also understood the correct answer to this statement, which was, and I said, more or less in this voice, I said, "No, Donald, you're the man."
It's so funny, because it's not like, we don't think of him as a great consumer of literature.
I feel that.
Yeah.
I think he's, you know, he and the Queen of England are probably the least well-read world leaders.
Well, my apologies for talking about how we're not going to bring things back to Trump and then circling back
to
him.
These were all a very long time ago. This was long before he had any or expressed any political aspirations.
Right. And now here we are.
Yeah. So we've known him for ages, and now America's finding out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Salman, it was such a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time. Congrats on the book. It's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Our guest is a New York Times bestselling author for her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You. Her new book, Little Fires Everywhere, is available now, wherever books are sold. Please welcome to the show, author Celeste Ng, everybody.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so happy to have you. This book is fantastic. It takes place in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is where you're from.
Yep.
It takes place in the 90s. I want to start with why you chose to put it in the 90s.
The first reason was that it gave me a really good excuse to relive my teen years, which is not something that I ever thought I would actually say. But the real reason is that I wanted to look at sort of how far we'd come and then how far we hadn't come from race, class, all of those issues. I remember living in Shaker Heights in the 90s, and the way that we talked about race was really to say, I don't see race. And now that's sort of a punchline, right? And so I wanted to sort of look at the ways that we haven't really gone as far as we think we have.
Also, just reading it, I realized, oh, this is nice that in the 90s, like, the fact that anyone has a cell phone is mind-blowing. And so teenagers communicate the way it sounds like you communicate as a teenager.
Exactly. So it was before cell phones, before any kind of social media, before the internet was even really a thing. I needed the characters to have a little bit of space to have secrets, because these characters have a lot of things that they're keeping from each other and trying to hide and leave behind parts of their past. And it's a lot harder to do that now, and I wanted them to have that space.
And so you put it in Shaker Heights, and this is the town you grew up in, but I'm wondering if in the writing of the book and the researching the book, did you find out new things about where you were from?
I did. I learned way more about the Shakers, the religious community that used to own the land that became Shaker Heights, than any reasonable person needs to know. So anything you want to know about the Shakers now, I can talk about.
When you went to the library, all the Shaker books were available. None were checked out.
They were. The Shaker Heights Public Library actually has a really great local history room, and this is where local history librarians do the job when nobody else can. She pointed me to old newspapers, all kinds of books about the Shakers, everything. But I also learned that a lot of things that I thought were normal from growing up in Shaker Heights were actually not normal at all, both good and bad.
One thing you were talking about, there's a, which I did not realize either, there's a Halloween tradition. And this is sort of, is this come from the fact that the Shakers were very regimented and organized?
I think it does. Even though the Shakers were never actually living in Shaker Heights, somehow that rule-following nature sank into the ground and is permeated the community now. So in Shaker Heights, on Halloween, when it's time to trick-or-treat, the city runs the sirens at the fire station at 6 o'clock to let you know that it's time to start. And then they run the sirens again at 8 o'clock to tell you that it's time to stop trick-or-treating. And I thought that everybody did that.
Uh-huh.
We didn't realize that that wasn't true until a good girlfriend of mine who grew up in Shaker Heights lives near me, and we both have little kids, and we were talking to our husbands who didn't grow up in Shaker Heights, and we said, okay, so when does trick-or-treating start? And our husbands looked at us and said, what do you mean, when does it start? It starts when you put on the costume and you go outside and you ring a doorbell. And we said, well, when does it end? Like, when do you stop? And they said, what do you mean, when does it end? It ends when you come home and you stop ringing doorbells. And my girlfriend just looked at me and said, well, this is just chaos.
Yeah. That it's, and now I just have to ask, is there, through the rest of your life, your adult life, when you hear a fire engine, do you have a Pavlovian candy?
A little bit. I want to go and ring somebody's doorbell.
Yeah, just like, I hope your house is on fire. Also, can I have a Kit Kat? You were actually, so you've been doing readings, doing a book tour, and you rescheduled. Thank you so much for rescheduling to be here, but you were going to read in Shaker Heights tonight.
I was supposed to read in my hometown where the book is set, so I hope that they forgive me. I hope this was a good enough reason.
Yes, I think they will forgive you, but you also, you know, you talk about the people in this town. Do you have any worries about that versus any other reading across the country that you do?
A little bit, yeah. I'm kind of nervous about that just because it's a little bit writing about a relative or like writing about your grandma. You know, you love them and you want everybody to see the good things about them, but you also know all their weird habits and their weird quirks, and you want to kind of reveal those too.
Do you think it's a good, if I'm in a Shaker Heights book club, is this a good book for us?
I think so. I think that the Shaker Heights population will have a lot of things to talk about. I hope they see themselves in the book, and they also sort of question, like, okay, well, do we mean to do that, or is that just kind of how we
and if there's a character that they don't like, I bet they'll see someone else in the book club as that character.
Yeah. I don't think they'll see it's them. Like, yeah. It's my next door neighbor.
Yeah, that's definitely Megan. Your parents were scientists. Your dad worked at NASA.
Yeah, he was a physicist.
And what did they feel when you have two scientists when you say you want to be a writer?
I think they were really nervous, but I think they kind of knew it was coming because I was an early reader, and ever since I was a kid, I was the one who was, like, off in the corner drawing little books and making up stories, and I used to write plays, and I would make my cousins perform them. And so I think they were nervous because this was a world they didn't know. They didn't know how to do anything. And so when I told my mother that I was going to go and get a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, she said, okay. And then we got off the phone, and the next day she sent me an email where she said, okay, I've talked to my friend who is the chair of the English department here at our university. She was the chair of the chemistry department. And she said, he assures me that a Master of Fine Arts is a real degree. and that it qualifies you to teach writing, which she wrote with a capital W, and artsy stuff. And so she was like, okay, this is, you know, I think you'll be able to, you know, buy food and pay for your rent.
Well, they were right. They were right on that account. And thank you so much for being here. Congratulations on the book. Celeste King, everybody, her new book, Little Fires Everywhere, is available now.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage here with Celeste Ng after her interview with Seth. She's the author of the new novel, Little Fires Everywhere. You just spoke with Seth about the book. I wanted to ask a couple of other questions. Was it scary for you to embark upon another novel? This is your second. After the success, the tremendous success you had with your first one.
It was a little bit scary because I think by nature I'm a people pleaser, and having had such a warm response to the first novel, I really wanted to get the second novel right. I wanted to write something that my readers would still connect with. But I tried to think of it as the reader sort of being in my corner and hoping that they would be willing to follow me into this new world.
Right. You said that you actually got the idea for Little Fires Everywhere while you were writing Everything I Never Told You.
I did. I was at the stage in Everything I Never Told You where I knew that there were problems in the manuscript. I knew I had to fix them. I wasn't totally sure how to do that. And this new idea popped into my head for a different family in a different book. And I thought, that story seems great. It has none of the problems of this current book. I'm going to work on that. And so I started writing down the very first pages of what became Little Fires Everywhere. And of course, at a certain point, found it had all the same problems as the first book and went back and finished the first book. But I think that was my brain kind of spinning, you know, in the back of my mind.
Well, I thought it was so funny when we spoke earlier that you said that you were congratulating yourself about how quickly you wrote the second book and then had a moment of hesitation.
Yeah, I was so proud of myself because the writing of the second book, the actual typing it out into the computer, went pretty fast. It took about a year and a half, 2 years. And I thought, oh, great, I've learned so much. I've gotten so much faster. And then I went back and I looked at my notes and I saw that I had started thinking about this book in 2009. So it actually took at least as long as the first book, maybe a little bit longer.
Right. I thought one of the most interesting dynamics in the book was the relationships between Pearl and Mrs. Richardson and Izzy and Mia. And so for those that haven't read it yet, it's just two different mothers and two different daughters and their connection with the other mother. Why was that important to you?
Well, I was really interested in the sort of difference between the mother that you're born to and then the mother that maybe you choose or that finds you somewhere along the way. What happens when your biological mother, the mother that you get, isn't able to give you some of the things that you need to sort of find your way in life. Mm-hmm. I think that happens a lot because mothers often are too close to their own children, especially daughters, to be able to see them clearly, both their faults and also their good sides.
Right.
And so in this case, the daughters are sort of drawn to the other mother. And I wanted to explore all the complications and, you know, the guilt, but also the sort of power that they find from these different role models.
Yes. I've had another great part of the novel is that you were clearly hyper aware of portraying these characters as all being empathetic, even though people came from different places and had different motivations and the reader might not agree with one or the other, but there was no clear villain.
Yeah, I really wanted to write a story in which there wasn't a villain. You know, there was no bad guy who was over there, you know, twirling their mustache. And I wanted to write a story where there wasn't a hero either, where I think all of the characters are trying their best to do what they think is the right thing. And all of them make some pretty questionable decisions, mm-hmm. but my goal is that the reader can at least understand why they got there. One of the things that I think is fascinating is that bad guys don't usually think they're the bad guys. They think they're being the good guys. And that's kind of how I wanted the characters in this book to be.
Yeah. Well, I think you are tremendously successful. It's been a huge hit in our office. If you could see this podcast, you could see all the books that I have asked her to sign. Thank you so much for coming. And hopefully when you write your next novel, you'll come back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Rhea Seehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.